My question was concerning, I guess, having enough faith. And we talked about living between the times.
Right.
and how it was sort of ludicrous, you mentioned, to think that, oh, by having enough faith, we could be healed, or if we only just prayed enough.
Oh, I didn't mean to say that, that it would be ludicrous to have enough faith to be healed.
Okay.
No, faith would surely be related to healing.
Okay. But that
what I was critiquing was the idea of saying to somebody who's sick, if you only had enough faith, you'd be healed.
Okay.
See, there's a difference between the two.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to clarify that. and then I was wondering about what Jesus said in Matthew 21 after the cursing of the fig tree.
I can't get too near you.
It says, and Jesus answered them, truly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what has been done to the fig tree, but even if you say to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, it will happen. Whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive if you have faith. And I guess I wondered how those two thoughts could be reconciled.
Oh, okay. Well, let's work on this one just for a moment. First of all, again, I want to emphasize that when I was speaking about faith and healing, I'm firmly convinced that there's a link between faith and healing. What makes me angry, to be perfectly frank, what makes me angry is when you have someone, say, suffering from cancer or another very serious disease, and I've seen this done, and a person will walk in and in a well-meaning way say to somebody, what's the problem? If you only had enough faith, you'd be healed. Well, I have known people of immense faith, you know, crying out to God, and I performed their funeral. So my point is that on the one hand, all that we do in the spiritual life, everything is connected to faith. I mean, every possible thing, but we don't want to be presumptuous. We don't want to be presumptuous in the sense of thinking that we can determine the reason why, for instance, one person is healed and one person dies. One person is blithely driving down the road drunk and swerves off the road and misses a tree and lives to the ripe old age of 80, comes to know Christ, on and on and on, and you have a 15-year-old full of faith, blows a tire, hits a tree, and is burned alive. What we're talking about is the relationship between faith and the events of our lives. Faith and what we call theologically God's providence. So Jesus clearly exhorts us to have faith. So when he uses this illustration in Matthew 7, and isn't that wild? If you have the faith, you know, if you just had a little bit of faith, you could say to this mountain, be moved into the sea, and be moved into the sea. What do you think? Well, that's hyperbole. That's purposeful exaggeration for the sake of making a point. Common rabbinical technique. And what is he saying? He's saying, with faith, you can accomplish great things. And I've seen it happen in my own life. I've seen it happen in the lives of some of you here. So and what is faith? What is faith? Faith is embracing Christ and trusting that Christ will act on our behalf in the best way possible. It's thinking big, not thinking small, because of who he is. Not because of something that I can, engineer in myself, a raised emotional state, for instance. That's what St. John of the Cross criticizes. That, in fact, he says that sometimes God will introduce this dark night of the soul into a person's life to wean them from thinking that faith or great faith is demonstrated by some internal feeling of delight or exhilaration or even expectation. Faith, let me say that again. This is so important. Faith is embracing Christ even when it's midnight. That's faith. That's great faith, is it not? Faith is looking away from oneself and looking to Him and saying, I will follow you. I will trust you to the end of my life for however many years you give me. And then the angels in heaven rejoice. But when it comes then to the answers to prayer, we'll actually get into this, so I won't spend too much time on it today. When it comes to the question of the answers to prayer, that gets very complicated because it's related to God's providence. Now, here's my definition of God's providence. God's ordering of human history. God's governance of human history. And every one of you have already wondered about this because there's been one time at least you prayed with all your heart that God would act in a given manner, and it seemed that God remained silent or did just the opposite. Some of you have experienced that, yes? And we all will at least once. So what the fathers, the church fathers, these early great theologians of the church said, is that God's providence itself is inexplicable. And then they said, I think I've mentioned this before, don't judge on the basis of appearances. So how to put this? You can have, in fact, I just saw this happen. My roommate, in my Jesus freak days, he and I called each other Rooms, so I'll just mention his name as Rooms. He met his wife at the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse, this Jesus freak Bible school back in the late 60s, early 70s. Carol and I watched them. It was kind of one of those neat things. I might watch them meet each other, and you could see the light exchanging between them and the little explosions of love and so on and so forth. And the next thing I know, you know, they're engaged, and then they get married. And they were married for, well, nigh, I think, 34, 35 years. Well, the last 11 years of her life, she had cancer. And she died last December. She was a woman of immense faith. Immense faith. And I do not know why she is not still with us. I would be presumptuous for me to come up with a flippant answer such as, I've sometimes heard this, well, you know, Jesus thought there was more for her to do in heaven than on earth, something like that. Well, how do we know that? It's not all that helpful. All I know is Lloyd is mourning the loss of his wife, but he's mourning the loss of his life with great, what? Faith. Both embracing Christ, and then what's that block letter word? Do you remember? Trusting. 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 And that trust will take place in lots of different contexts as great faith is being exercised. For some of us, as we talk about the issue of vocation, you know, what are you going to do with your life? You're going to have to trust, because God's not going to tell you as clearly as you would like or at the time you would like to know. For some of us, it's going to have to do with events that happened in our family or have already happened in our family. We're going to have to trust. For some of us, we're going to get sick, and we're going to think, you know, I prayed my eyeballs out now. Hello? You said, ... if you ask anything in my name, I'm asking, and we'll have to trust. We'll get into more of the issue of why prayers might turn out in such a fashion when we talk about prayer. Prayer, for many of us, faith will force us out of our comfort zone for our own sake. We'll take a look in just a moment in a passage from Francois Fenelon in Devotional Classics. And he talks about people who are divided. They want to set down roots deeply here, and yet they want Christ. And at times, God will seem silent or work in other ways providentially to help us move to that place of trust. But it's very hard. It's not easy. That movement to that place of trust is, I think, one of the most difficult movements in the spiritual life, because it goes dead set against our nature as incurvatu sensei. Can you see how if we're curved in on ourselves? If that's just the way, if by the fall we're wired like that, then as we're getting straightened out, there's a resistance that takes place. So faith is embracing Christ. Ever more deeply embracing Christ. Now, in devotional classics, turn to François Fénelon. Now, take a look at Fénelon. He's a wonderful writer on the spiritual life, and French, as you can tell by his name, late 17th, early 18th century. Section 1. Those who are gods, five lines down about, those who are gods are always glad. He's talking about not some kind of light gladness here. This is section 1, François Fénelon. When they are not divided. See that? When they are not divided. Go to section 2. How is it titled? A will that is no longer divided. They sacrifice themselves, but to what they love most. So this question of a divided will is related to love. To love. And because we can have skewed loves, God will work in such a way providentially in our lives to how to say, rinse out, this is a really a mixed metaphor, rinse out the skewed loves, straighten out the skewed loves so that we love what's truly lovable and we're no longer divided. And then that love becomes perfect. Now, I want you to remember this. I'm going to talk about it just for 2 minutes. Look at section 4, transported with joy. Go down to the last sentence. The more one loves God, this is a love for which we are wired, for which we are created. The more one loves God, the more one is content. That feeling of settledness, that feeling of peace, the feeling like I'm at the right place, things are going to be all right, might be hard for the time being. And then he says, the highest perfection, instead of overloading us, makes our yoke lighter. Now, this is really important. This will show up on the midterm, if not on the quiz. When the great writers on the spiritual life, like François Fénelon, speak of perfection, they do not mean, asterisk, they do not mean someone who has a long list of laws and rules and regulations and is able to follow those regulations perfectly, hence they're perfect. The perfect person, almost invariably in these writings, is not that kind of person. The perfect person is the one who has fully matured into love, fully moved into love. In fact, the Greek word for perfect, at least one of the meanings of this word, is telos, T-E-L-O-S. Telos, T-E-L-O-S. Imagine it this way. So you have, although we're skewed, as you come to know Christ and are reborn in Christ, there's now spiritual DNA in you. This beginning to work its way out into your life. Spiritual DNA. It's like an acorn has DNA in the acorn, and you plant the acorn in the ground, and over time, what develops? Something it does not look like the acorn, it looks like what? An oak tree. Now, from the perspective of these writers, see if I can pull this off. From the perspective of these writers, that oak tree is perfect because it reflects fully the DNA that was in the acorn. So spiritually speaking, Christ has, it's like, I kind of like this. Christ has performed or is performing gene therapy on us. Gene therapy. And he does so by, through the Spirit, injecting into us his genes, his DNA, so that the perfect Christian is that one who, through any number of means that we'll talk about, prayer amongst them, is growing. Can you see it? Those the DNAs being healed, the helixes are coming back to what they should be, the chromosomes are what they should be. And what you end up with is a human being. A real human being, the way she's supposed to be and was always meant to be. She's been healed, she's been reborn, she's been regenerated. And what's the result? Love. That's perfection. And that's what phenolon means by perfection. So he speaks out strongly against this idea of a divided will, knowing that a divided will, picture yourself on the dock, will only get somebody wet. To speak more strongly, get somebody killed. But a will that allows that gene therapy to take place says to Christ, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you. Here's my arm. Inject it, you know, I'm ready for the therapy. Over time, that person will change. And the result is someone who's really human, Christ being the most deeply human person who ever lived. Make sense? Now, turn over to Augustine. He talks about being weighed down by habit and torn between conflicting wills. I'm going to read it slowly, but I think we've all experienced this. You'll probably experience this dynamic at least once today. For the will commands that an act of will should be made. So sometime today, you're going to know you're supposed to do something. The will commands that an act of will should be made, and it gives this command to itself, not to some other will. The reason then why the command is not obeyed is it's not given with the full will. That's a divided will, right? For if the will were full, it would not command itself to be full, since it would be so already. Clear? Now here's what's interesting. It is therefore no strange phenomenon partly to will to do something and partly not to will to do it. Think Romans 7 if you're familiar with that chapter. Now catch this next line. What's the problem? What's the problem? It is a disease of the mind which does not wholly rise to the heights where it is lifted by the truth because it is weighed down by habit. That's the problem. Spiritual growth is in some ways simply a reformation supernaturally by the Spirit of fundamental habit patterns in our lives. Here's a good definition. I'm going to ask you about this. Comes to mind. Good definition of character, human character, of my character is the sum of my habit patterns. How I habitually conduct myself day in and day out, that's who I am. That makes sense, doesn't it? And if you lived with me, you'd see what they were. And some are good, some are bad. Now what Augustine is saying is a curved, skewed will makes choices, right? And those choices become what? They become habitual. And as they become habitual, the will becomes increasingly crippled, making further bad choices. And the result is someone whose character is not what it should be. And then that's the fallen human nature. Add it all up, you get corporate flesh. The world. Make sense? You with me so far? All right. So we have world, we have flesh, and then take a look at this overhead here. So again, here on point number two, these are some of the texts that we looked at last class. I particularly want you to remember that one from Romans chapter 12, verse 2. That's J.B. Phillips' translation. And that's where he speaks of the world, that corporate flesh, that unholy force field, trying to squeeze us into its mold. So not only is the opposition that we're facing something that is resident within us, within our own fallen human nature. It's present in the world. And then if that was not enough, then just a word or two here about the devil. Let me read a few texts. All right, Ephesians chapter 2. It's very interesting when biblical writers talk about the devil, they avoid two extremes. On the one, you don't get an extravagant, exaggerated, overblown picture of the devil, where the devil is constantly on their mind, as though the devil's hiding behind every bush and someone that we should be deeply terrified of. And on the other hand, you don't get this kind of false sophistication where who could possibly believe that the devil exists in the modern world attitude. I can almost hear the devil himself saying, "Oh, really? The devil? Red suit, I suppose, horns, cloven hoofs, tail. Who could believe in someone like that, really? Aren't we beyond that?" No, they avoid both extremes and talk soberly, directly, to the point. If you take a look in Ephesians 2:2, actually, I'll start with verse 1. "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world," corporate flesh, "and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient." So he speaks of a spirit who is at work in the world, a spirit. "All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were objects, by nature objects of wrath, but because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ." We get that gene therapy. So there's this mention here in Paul of a spirit who is at work in the world. Turn over to Ephesians 6 here. He could not be more direct. Starting with verse 10. "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes." So let's think through how he describes the devil or Satan or Lucifer. He uses the word spirit. Here he uses the word the devil's schemes. Think back to Genesis 3, the picture you have of the serpent in Genesis 3, who's identified with Satan in the New Testament. So the spirit is a schemer, crafty. Jesus says he's a liar and a murderer from the beginning. So it seems that this supernatural being has that in his heart of hearts, the desire to take a human being made in the image of God or God's creation itself and destroy it, work against it, undercut it, harm it, if such were possible. So Paul says here in verse 12, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood." It's not on that level. "But against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." So when Jesus comes and announces the arrival of the kingdom, one of the characteristics of the inbreaking of the kingdom is what? These very intense exorcisms that are taking place. Why? The kingdom of this world and its king is now being invaded by the king. And see, it's not an even match. We don't need to be afraid when we talk about these kinds of things. It's not an even match. Whenever any of these demons, for example, in the Gospels encounter Christ, they're scared spitless, to speak metaphorically. They're afraid. And I can remember one of them saying, "Why are you here before the time? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And Jesus says, "Fimothete, shut up, be silent, come out of him." So the demon wanted to debate theology. Christ shouldn't be there yet. He's the Holy One of God, and Jesus with one word rebukes him. But Paul feels that it's important that we realize that what we encounter spiritually, the conflict that we can experience spiritually, is multi-layered. Multi-layered. Now, here's the wonderful thing. In faith, as we embrace whom? As we embrace Christ, the victory is won. And yet these writers say, do not be naive. One last text here. This is a great section. This is 1 Peter chapter 5, starting with verse 6. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. So that's a picture of a human being coming to Christ. It's a nice stance before Christ, just kneeling down before Christ. I can see Christ smiling, kind of hovering over them, raising them up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. No need for worry. And then he says, this is the Apostle Peter. So these are the two great apostles of the church, Paul and Peter, both speaking of the devil. And then Peter says, be self-controlled and alert. Now I want you to write both down for me. Be self-controlled and alert. Another way to translate alert would probably be, if this is helpful, be vigilant. And so you might ask yourself the question, this is a hard journaling exercise, in what areas am I struggling with the issue of self-control? Where's my life out of control? You know, and for some of us it has to do with money. It's a fairly limited playing field here in terms of vices. For some of us, it has to do with money. For some of us, it has to do with sex. For some of us, it has to do with envy, food, any number of things. Be self-controlled. So where is he calling you to self-control? Some of it has to do with anger, perhaps. And alert. So where do I need to open my eyes to see what's happening? Where am I not being vigilant? And then he says, your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that your brothers throughout the world are encountering the same kinds or same kind of suffering. So Peter calls us to resistance. Christ calls us to resistance. This is a multi-layered resistance. So do not think it strange then. Think of your flesh. If Christ will call us to resist our tendency towards self-indulgence, and hence the discipline of fasting. Fasting tends to put a brake on self-indulgence. For example, my personality, I have basically a self-indulgent personality, which means I want what I want when I want it. So if I'm hungry, you know, I want Dunkin' Donuts right now. I need Dunkin' Donuts right now. I know I need it. I must have it. And so I really don't like the discipline of fasting, but I'm surely called to fast. Why? It puts a brake on that tendency towards self-indulgence. So that's the resistance to my what? Fallen human nature. We'll be called to resist the corporate flesh around us from time to time. Ask yourself this question. Where is he just asking me to say no? No. Our culture's saying loudly and clearly, yes, 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 and Christ is saying, not at that point. Not at that point. I'm going to ask you to say a no. And there's a resistance that we're called to and an alertness that we're called to cultivate. And then don't be naive. At times we'll be directly attacked spiritually. I tend to identify these kinds of attacks with just those kinds of, have I been just kind of driving along the road? And I can remember in France, this happened to me. It's great, last two or three weeks have been great. Things are going fine, I'm driving along the road, and suddenly, out of nowhere, just this heated temptation. Does that happen to you? Just out of nowhere. And then you feel like someone is preying on the cracks in your own personality. Well, that tends to be then its kind of spiritual attack. Do we need to be afraid? Absolutely not. What do we need to do? What I find helpful is just a prayer of protection and a prayer of rebuke. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, get behind me. And life goes on. But it's Christ's power, not my own. So spiritual growth and development and conflict is multi-layered. Okay, let's move on here to this new topic that I'm going to call personality, place, and provision. We're going to move into a time in class when we analyze issues that I think are really important for you. They're in some ways less important for me because I've found my vocation. I know what I'm supposed to do, and I'm in the back stretch. You know, I'm 58, I got about 12 more years of energy left. Now there's this little red light that's blinking at the end of the tunnel, beep, beep, and so on. You know, I'm in the backstretch. You're starting out. Christ wants to do something with your life. So, when you see personality, this has to do with the question, who am I? Who am I in terms of my strengths, my weaknesses, my gifting? Who am I? Who has Christ created me to be? And then we have place. Place has to do with the idea, in light of the gifting that God has given me, what am I called to do? And at this point, we want to move away from over-spiritualizing things in this sense. Sometimes folks can come to Eastern, and it concerns me. Sometimes they can come to Eastern and think, I am only serving God if I'm in the, quote, ministry. Only really finding something of value if I'm going to be on the mission field or out on the circuit speaking or whatever. Now, wait a minute. What if when God was thinking of you in God's eyes and mind before you were ever created, and he looked at you and he thought, I am going to create her with a love for bugs. She's just going to love them. And a person like that comes to Eastern and wants to study science and wants to study finally entomology, probably in graduate school, and spend most of her life perhaps in Ghana tracking down African wolf spiders, all to the glory of God. Well, that's vocation. And it's just as spiritual as some soul that God is calling to teach biblical studies at a seminary somewhere. So at the very beginning, we want to think widely in terms of place. And a seed I want to plant, even at the beginning, is this. What do you really like to do? I mean, when you're doing it, doesn't matter. And you move away from your peer group. You move away from what other people would approve of or disapprove of. But you know, when I am doing this, I feel fulfilled. I feel like this is what I'm wired for. Well, it well could be that wiring has been created in you by God, that desire planted in you by God. We'll explore those issues over the next few classes. So that's who you are, what you're called to do, and then provision is a very simple principle. God will provide whatever we need to do what he asks us to do. The operative word there being whatever we need. Not necessarily whatever we would like or whatever we would desire, but whatever we need to do what he calls us to do. Now you can see here, I've asked this question about the good life. It's a question the Greeks asked. It's the question the early Christian community asked, Plato asked it, Aristotle asked it, Augustine asked it. They all talk about what's the good life. Now think of corporate flesh and ask yourself the question, living in North America, how does our culture tend to identify the good life? I want you to think that one through. What's the good life? Well, this is pretty easy stuff. The good life would be wealth. The good life would be beauty, handsomeness, the good life would be a large house, hot car, many women or men. So I want you to think through, how does our society define the good life? You might even journal about that. And then ask yourself the question, how have I been affected by those definitions? This came home to me when I was about, it was in 1985. So I was 35. And I, at that time, was a pastor in France living at the foot of the French Alps. It was a wonderful job. I had a nice salary. Most beautiful place in the world to live, wonderful church. And Christ seemed to be saying to me, both in me and through the community around me, Chris, you're supposed to teach. You need to go back to graduate school. I'm 35. So I applied to graduate school. I wasn't nearly ready for doctoral work. And went up to a graduate school in Canada, Regent College. So we came back from France, flew across the country to LA, bought a little Mazda hatchback for $5,000, which was a huge amount of money at that time, and started driving up the coast with two little kids and my wife and me. And the money in the bank account just slowly draining out on this new adventure. And I distinctly remember I began to think, I don't know. I'm really sticking my neck out on this one. Mm-hmm. And we got to a place called Foster City. Anybody know Foster City? It's just south of San Francisco. It's a really beautiful place on the bay, and there's all these beautiful condominiums and so on and so forth. Well, a different roommate in college was now pastor of a church in Foster City. And he had this condo to kill for. And we were staying with him on the way up to Vancouver as I'm watching the money slowly drain out of my bank account. And I got up one morning before anybody else did. I think it was a Sunday morning, and there was a San Francisco Chronicle, and I was paging through the Chronicle. And as I was reading, I came to an article, by the age of dot, 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 your net worth should be dot, 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 or, in a manner of speaking, you will fail to enter fully into, guess what, the good life. You'll be financially insecure. Your children will die of hunger. I mean, on and on and on and on in my mind's eye. All it was basically statistics. So I looked. By the time you're 35, you should be worth, I think it was something like $50,000. I'm nowhere near. I am nowhere near. And I'm thinking, this panic came over me. I'm going to miss the good life. I've made a mistake. Here's the chart. The chart. It's in black and white. Ah, what am I going to do now? Panic. Panic. Not faith. Panic. What's the good life? I remember I got up to Vancouver, and it was like a faculty fireside. And there was this real sweet professor up there. I love him to death. But he tends to be direct and sometimes a little bit quirky. And we're going around in the group, and we finally get up to Vancouver, and we find a place to live and so on. He's from Australia, and he's asking the different graduate students, why are you here at Regent? And so it got to me, and I said, well, I really want to get into a PhD program, but I don't have enough background yet to probably even get into one. So I'm here at Regent to get a master's degree and hopefully do well and then apply to a PhD program because I'd really like to teach in a university. His response, oh, nearly impossible, you know, nearly impossible. Next student. And I thought, you know, that's great. That's great. I already know I'm in debt. The chart's telling me I'm in real trouble. And now my first professor I meet says, impossible. That's great. This is far from the good life. Well, then what happened was, by a miracle, I get into a doctoral program, and I told that professor immediately, ha! Look at that! I'm in! So I'm in this doctoral program, but then now there's, I mean, the bank account, nada, nothing. And I can remember two things. I think my daughter both times, she was cute little girl, and one time she came up and she looked at me and said, "Dad, are we ever going to live in a house?" And I thought, "Lord, this is not easy." And then a few days later, just to torture me more deeply, mean-spirited child that she is, he said, "Dad, are we ever going to have a dog?" And I can remember distinctly thinking, "Lord, this is not, I'm going to trust you here, but really, is this the good life?" Do you see how this relates to issues of vocation? Our expectations of what the good life is and what a good life look like are so important. Because Jesus will say, he said this. Here's the good life. This is our Lord. "If anyone wishes to follow me, let him take up his cross." Jesus Christ. Might that be the good life? What do the great martyrs of the church think? What did the great martyrs of the church think as they were led away? What did Peter think as he was led away? This is the good life. And yet, it's this upside down thing again. This topsy-turvy kingdom where sometimes by all appearances, everything's going wrong when actually everything's going right. Christ did want me to come back. He did want me to go to Regent College. He did want me to go to Drew. And he wants me to spend the rest of my life at Easter. And here I'm getting to do what I always wanted to do, spend time with you. You can't beat it. You just can't beat it. But there were distinct junctures along the way when I had to deal with that, my personality, so that when I finally began to teach people, I didn't harm them, but actually might be able to help them. I had to work through this whole issue of vocation and then the question of provision. God provides what we need, but no promises to become wealthy. No promises to become wealthy, because probably that's not the most important thing or the most needful thing. Personality, place, provision. All right. Let's talk about personality. Now, on point number two here, we're in the back stretch. On point number two, I want you to write, these are the key words, steward and sinner. Steward and sinner. And just so you know, in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, in Ephesians chapter 4, and in Romans chapter 12, we get what I would call a Pauline Whitman sampler of spiritual gifts. It's a kind of a Whitman sampler. He it's not an exhaustive list. There's different gifts sometimes listed. There's overlap between the lists. He just says, every disciple of Christ is gifted in some way. I think almost anything can be a spiritual gift. But so Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, Ephesians 4, you can take a look at those gift lists. And maybe as you look at them, some gifts will just leap off pages of the scripture at you, and they can help provide a compass as to, you know, maybe the direction you should head. I had no idea that I was supposed to teach until I got asked when I was at this Jesus Street Bible School to teach a young college-aged group at a Presbyterian church down in Pacific Palisades. And some gift appeared. All right. And you know what Matthew 25 is? Matthew 25 is the story of the talents. It's contained there, and so one person is given 5 talents, one's given 3 talents, one's given 1 talent, a talent of measurement. And God holds us responsible for what we're given. Now catch this. God holds us responsible for what we're given God does not hold us responsible for what we're not given. So we don't need to be comparing. We don't need to be thinking, you know, because I don't have this gift, I'm not valuable. You know? Everybody else had a present under the Christmas tree. I looked, nothing for me. I am the one human being, the one member of the church who never got a gift. No. Everybody gets them. The key becomes discovering what they are. So, in some ways, this is the easier part of things. That's what I mean by steward. Being a steward, a safekeeper, a trustee of sorts of what God gives to us. That's where your desires come in, because your desires are often linked to your gifts, your spiritual gifts. Think that one through with me. Your desires are often linked to where you're gifted by God. So think big, think broadly in terms of gifting and what you could do with your life. Don't think narrowly. Now here's the problem. Our gifting is manifest through our character. And that's where things get dangerous. Our gifting is exercised through our character. And if our character is skewed, if our character has not entered into spiritual discipline, you can have someone who's deeply gifted exercising those gifts and everything implodes. And have we not seen this in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s? I bet, I won't ask you to do it, but I would bet any number of you have been in churches where you perhaps even sat under the teaching of a great pastor, but something happened. His character, her character wasn't deeply formed and shaped, and the pressure of that ministry, the stress of that ministry pressing upon that character revealed its cracks. And then oftentimes have fallen to sin of some kind. Financial shenanigans, sexual sin of some kind, embezzlement, I mean, all kinds of things. So we're stewards and we're sinners. So the question then becomes this: how does Christ help us? How does Christ help us to exercise whatever he calls us to do safely? And he does so by calling us into relationship and revealing where we need to change. Revealing where we need to change. And it hurts. And at times it's frightening. And at times we want to say, this is too much, you're asking too much. I can't face this, I can't face that. And he says the whole time, oh yes you can, because I'm going to use your life. But you have to be safe. You have to be sane. You have to be well, or you'll hurt people with that gifting and not help them. And the primary example that we're going to use to study how Christ does this with people is the Apostle Peter. So I want you to write down these texts for me. Okay? Write down these texts for me. They're all from Matthew's Gospel and one from John's. And I want you to read them for next class. So we're going to start Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14, the story of Jesus walking on the water. And then Matthew 16, starting with verse 13, when Jesus is identified as the Christ by Peter. And then on into Matthew chapter 26. And in Matthew 26, I want you to read through that chapter and note wherever Peter's name is mentioned. And then we're going to be in John chapter 21. You've been great today. I appreciate that. Have a good day, and I'll see you on Thursday. God bless.